Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a real-world version of the Hunger Games coming to a country near you. Michael Clare, the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, joins us. We will discuss his article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. Then we look into the fire at the Chevron oil refinery in Richmond, California, that is causing a sudden spike in gas prices on the West Coast. Roger Kim, the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, who has been active in environmental issues with citizens in the community surrounding the refinery, joins us to discuss local anger at Chevron and why the refinery built in 1902 has had problems with fires following a 2007 fire that shut down the refinery for that year's first quarter. Then finally, we will speak with David Marples, the president of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies, about how Europe's last dictatorship has dealt with the attack of the teddy bears. Following a prank by a Swedish public relations firm that parachuted 800 teddy bears into a town in Belarus, the Swedish ambassador to Belarus has been expelled by the country's paranoid dictator, Lukashenko, who retaliated in a fit of fury, firing a slew of generals in charge of air defenses who failed to protect the motherland. And joining us now is Michael Clare, a Five College professor in Peace and World Security Studies and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Always a pleasure to join you.
And the idea that the movie, The Hunger Games, is actually going to come to a country near us is an alarming prospect. And not, of course, in your Mother Jones article, you point out that the United States is not quite that vulnerable. Food prices in the United States represent about 13% of the average household budget. But with the likely increases from the current droughts here in the United States, food prices will obviously go up and affect the people at the lower end of the economic scale. And which, given that the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, they alone control or have the equivalent wealth of 40% of Americans at the lower end of the income bracket. Leads you to understand that there are a lot of Americans out there who will be affected by the rising food prices.
Well, exactly right. 13% of our budget for wealthy people isn't going to be a terrible problem, but that's just an average. And there are a lot of unemployed people in this country. There are a lot of people living on just a few dollars a day, or, you know, maybe that's an exaggeration, but people, you know, living from day to day on what they have. And if prices of food go up, that's really going to hurt them, especially, you know, poor families with a lot of mouths to feed. This is going to be a real hardship.
So this is not the first time that we've experienced these spikes in food prices. And in many ways, the spike in food prices from 2007 to 2011 led to the Arab Spring. But let's go through some of the causes of these spikes. They vary. In part, there is, of course, the rising price of the cost of oil, which underlies a lot of the farming operations, particularly in the first world, with irrigation, food delivery, manufacture of pesticides and fertilizers. That is already contributed to the cost of food. And I understand that going to ethanol, as we have here in the United States, we've even increased the price of food in that regard. So walk us through these spikes, starting with the oil, and then we'll move on to the current manifestations of climate change.
Sure. Well, the first big spike occurred in 2008, and I'm sure your listeners are aware that that's when oil prices also went through the roof. And it's pretty clear that the rise in oil prices, when oil was selling for $140 a barrel and, you know, shot up in California for over $4 or $5 a gallon, that doubled the cost of oil for the production of food around the world. And as a result, the price of corn, rice, wheat, and many other staple products around the world doubled very swiftly. And this created immense pain and hardship for poor families around the world. There were riots and upheavals in two to three dozen countries, Cameroon, Egypt, Pakistan, and Haiti, especially in our part of the world. In Haiti, it became so severe that UN peacekeepers who were there for political reasons were called out to protect government facilities against rioting, desperate people clamoring for food. Five people died there. In Africa, scores were killed. So the rise of food prices is so has such a powerful effect on the lives of poor people in many parts of the world that it triggers political action right away. Now, that was largely caused in 2008 by the rising cost of fuel. The next big price spike in 2010 and 2011 was pretty much produced by global climate change. If you could remember the summer of 2010, it seemed like half of Russia was up in flames because it was so hot, and the wheat crop was destroyed there. There were also tremendous drought conditions in Argentina and Australia and China and parts of the United States. So once again, you had a huge increase in the price of wheat for making bread. And these prices started to roll over into the beginning of 2011 and started to affect North Africa, where in Egypt, Tunisia, where bread is the basic staple, at a time when disgust with corrupt and authoritarian governments was already at a feverish pitch. And the combination of rising food prices and the government indifference to the plight of the poor is what triggered the Arab Spring, first in Tunisia, then spread to Egypt, and of course to other parts of the Middle East. And I think now we're facing another, perhaps equally severe crisis, if not greater, because we're, again, global warming and high oil prices are going to combine now to push the price of food up around the world.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, who is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College and the author of the recent book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. So you talk about the Hunger Games, of course, an immensely successful young adult novel and a very successful movie. I think they're already making a sequel to it. How relevant is that kind of dystopian vision? How much is art imitating life here?
Well, I'll speak to that. First, I should say that my article appeared in Mother Jones Online, and the original article came from tomdispatch.com, if your listeners are interested in reading the article. But about Hunger Games, I found the movie very powerful, and I then turned to the book and discovered that the backdrop to the gladiatorial games that are portrayed in the movie are essentially what I'm talking about, global warming, heating up the planet, drought, and food scarcity in the United States, leading to a rebellion. The rebellion is crushed by the Capitol Panem, and the price that the rebels have to pay for their revolt is to sacrifice two teenagers each year for these televised gladiatorial games. Many of your listeners will be familiar with the story, but the backdrop is global warming, drought, and starvation. And I'm afraid we're going to see that, maybe not in this country, but in many parts of the world.
So how does this tie in then to your overall thesis, if you will, Michael Clare, in your new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources?
I think we're at a period today where all of the easily accessed, easily procured resources that we all depend on for survival and for industry, and I'm talking about water, food, land, oil, coal, copper, iron, and all of those things, has now been consumed, especially since World War II and the vast expansion of the global industrial base of modern civilization. So what's left now is very hard to obtain materials, hard to obtain resources, tough resources. I call it extreme energy, deep in underground, in the far north in the Arctic, deep offshore, fracking, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, which, by the way, requires a lot of water. So you're going to have a clash between the pursuit of the world's last resources and global warming clashing together, making for a desperate struggle, I fear, over what's left of the world's resources, unless we learn how to use resources in a much more frugal and prudent manner.
Well, that brings to mind, Michael Clare, what's going on in the tar sands of Alberta in Canada.
Exactly.
Because the apparently huge amounts of water required to bring the tar sands, take the tar out of the sands, the high pressure steam is used, and they use enormous amounts of water, which then go into these vast lakes, these brackish lakes. So at some point or other, I've talked to Canadian environmentalists, they say, you know, that the price of water is going to be equal to the price of oil, and the amount of water that's being used, you know, and being essentially destroyed as a resource is, at this point, but phenomenon. People that say if you fly over that area, it looks like the end of the world.
Exactly right. That's a very good example of what I'm saying. The easy resources are now gone, so we're pursuing things that nobody would bother with 25 years ago, like Canadian tar sands, because it's such a cruddy source of energy. But we're desperate for another fix of petroleum, and so we go after the tar sands or oil trapped in shale rock in this country. And to do that, you have to use extreme measures, environmentally dangerous and hazardous measures, and they all require a lot of water. And as you say, Ian, the water is not plentiful anymore and will be less so in the future, and we're going to have a struggle between those of us who want to eat every day and those who believe that fracking or tar sands production is more important. I think that's what it's coming down to.
So in other words, it's a choice between filling the gas tank or filling the stomach.
Yes, exactly.
So is there any, do you think that there's a growing awareness of what you're talking about? Because what was interesting about the Hunger Games, both the book and the movie, was that young people, teenagers, were drawn to it, even though it was deeply dystopian. So how do you explain that dystopian vision, yet the younger generation who are inheriting this world that we have screwed up for them, you know, are facing a bleak future?
You know, I think that young people are intensely aware of this bleak future they face, and there are those who say, well, we're just going to try to make the best of it and survive somehow, and those who more and more, I think, are going to become environmental activists. I certainly see that at my college, at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, where I teach, a growing number of students are becoming environmental activists as a result of what they see in the future. But I also understand young people who are so frightened by what they see that they go into denial, you know, and just engage in watching television and playing computer games. It's not hard to understand that.
Well, we are, of course, this year, 2012, this election year, we are witnessing one of the wealthiest families in this country, the Koch brothers. And I mentioned earlier how, just to give you an idea of the disparity in wealth in this country, that 40% of Americans at the lower end of the economic scale, their wealth is the equivalent to that of one family, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart family. And then, so you have the Koch brothers who are in the oil business, who are pouring money into the political process to buy the next Congress and hopefully the next Senate for them and Mitt Romney. And they may well be successful. So how long do you think before there'd be a countervailing political movement if the oligarchs in their sort of last death throes of unbridled greed are grabbing the last of the resources? I mean, I don't notice people going to supermarkets and not buying brawny paper towels and Dixie cups that the Koch brothers make money off. They own those companies. So there are it's not like people are boycotting these products, even at this point, when the writing's on the wall.
You know, I think that the forces of nature are getting out of control, and this will have an effect on everybody's life. How that will play out in political sphere, I don't know. The New York Times is reporting tomorrow, I see, that July was the hottest month on record in U.S. history since they kept records, and the last 12 months was the hottest 12 months in U.S. history since they kept records. Much of the eastern and middle and southern U.S. have their hottest temperatures ever recorded, and it's creating terrible misery for many people, for farmers especially, in those parts of the country. And I think it's going to get harder to deny the reality of climate change in the years ahead as the effects become more powerful. So I do think that this will have an effect. And the price of food is going to rise, the price of fuel is going to rise, and this will make people more aware. How that will play itself out politically is very hard to say, but the awareness of the magnitude of the problem is certain to grow.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of the new book, The Race for What's Left of the Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch and also at Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. But don't you think, Michael, that what this conversation's inevitably leading to in terms of, you know, I'm not talking about a utopian alternative to the dystopian Hunger Games future, but I'm suggesting that the inevitable alternative is to get off the corporate drug, whether it's corporate food, whether it's corporate energy, whether, you know, it's at some point or other, we all have to undergo a major social change, don't we, to free ourselves from these products that are destroying the planet and are destroying our health.
Well, I certainly think that what you say is true. Now, to what degree this will be a conscious political act and to what degree it will be forced upon us by the economy and by the climate is hard to say. You know, people aren't going to be able to afford to buy SUVs in the future. And so any business model based on SUVs or long drives out to the suburbs to the mall, that's not going to be possible anymore. So our lives will increasingly be dictated by economic and climate realities to adapt in new ways. And you know, corporations will either adapt to that or will perish in the end. And so to what degree we will make this a conscious decision to buy, you know, to scorn companies that fail to make wise, sustainable decisions, and to what extent this will be the product of the forces of nature, I can't say, but it will certainly happen. But I do think more and more people will choose to behave in a sustainable fashion and to protest those companies that persist in going in an unsustainable direction.
So do you think it'll be a case of choosing or will it be a case of necessity? If
It'll be both. It'll be both. And there'll be those people who will deny climate change and deny everything else, but they will be forced by necessity to adapt to a new world because a new world is coming.
Well, you know how much Al Gore has been lampooned, but in many ways he was the first to bring up this issue of global warming, at least in terms of the popular culture, with his film, An Inconvenient mm-hmm. Truth. And every day that passes, it's increasingly difficult to deny the obvious, even though there are these pernicious people like the Koch brothers and others who hire these academic whores to put out bogus studies saying climate change is a hoax. That, of course, slows down the extent to which we have that window of opportunity to deal with the problem itself. And I've talked to an awful lot of climate scientists to try and figure out, you know, how much the clock is ticking and whether or not we're running out of time. And one of the things that is so extraordinary about nature is that it's become self-reinforcing, the problem. As global warming increases, the climatic changes cause more and more methane to be released from the tundra, from as the ice melts, less light and heat is reflected back into outer space, and it's become self-reinforcing. And the more fresh water that is melted into the ocean, it slows down the currents and therefore affects the climates, and the whole, you know, planet becomes a kind of Sargasso Sea. So it's all, you know, it's all pretty clear. I hate getting involved in being the Cassandra, and I know, you know, this is not something that the audience enjoys listening to, but do you think we will reach a point soon where we won't have to deal with denial, but we'll have to deal with reality and deal with it very quickly?
You know, the way things change, Ian, is never, you know, you turn a switch from zero to one, you know, like they have on machines. Things change by more and more people moving in one direction and you reach a tipping point. And I do think that will occur. You'll see more and more people driving hybrids and more people abandoning the suburbs for the cities where they could use public transit. And right now it's not a majority. It's a minority of people who are more aware and more conscious. But that's going to gain momentum as conditions become more severe. And eventually it'll become, you know, a mass rush to abandon old ways of life and adapt to these new realities. It's like with smoking. You know, at first only a few people quit and everybody says, oh, I don't worry about that. But, you know, it reached a point where more and more people said we have to stop smoking. That's the way it's going to be. It will reach a tipping point. We're not there yet, but I think we will see it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Clare.
My pleasure, always.
I've just been speaking with Michael Clare, who is the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for the New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He has an article at Tom Dispatch and at Mother Jones, The Hunger Wars in Our Future, Heat, Drought, Rising Food Costs, and Global Unrest. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the explosion at the oil refinery in Northern California that's already causing a spike in gas prices.
The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud of. Love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
The bank now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Kim, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, which organizes and builds a leadership of Asian immigrants and refugee communities to achieve environmental and social justice. Before joining APEN, he worked at the Oakland Foundation as the Environmental Program Fellow and at Global Green USA. In addition, Mr. Kim is on the board of the Center for Environmental Health and the advisory committee to Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Kim.
Thanks for having me.
And the explosion that took place on Monday at the refinery, the Chevron's refinery in Richmond last night, residents of the community met in a very raucous meeting where the Chevron spokesman was roundly booed. What's your sense of whether or not the people in this community around this refinery are in danger and have been in danger?
I think the community members in Richmond have been in danger for much too long now. This is the second refinery fire in the last 5 years. Chevron has not replaced old equipment that's been a part of this refinery for 50, 60 years, some of the oldest parts of the refinery. And, my organization and others have been demanding changes to the refinery to make it operate more safely and pollute less. There's a lot of anger in the community, and rightly so. Chevron has not been a good neighbor. They have not been transparent nor accountable in creating these kinds of situations. So I think a lot of people are fed up.
Well, of course, Chevron is California's largest corporation and its single largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And this refinery was built in 1902. So clearly there is a problem here, isn't there? I mean, how much of the $27 billion in profits that Chevron made are turned back into upgrading this refinery? Do you know?
I do not know that, but we certainly know that, even in this year, they've made almost $13 billion in profits in the first two quarters. And yet we have a situation where, simple fixes to make sure that this refinery operates in the most safe possible manner are not being done. But I think it's also symptomatic of where the oil and fossil fuel industry is in this country and around the world. Eking out as much profit as possible on the backs and health of communities of color in particular, while our climate is getting hotter, and they're not making the investments in actually shifting us away from fossil fuels that companies should be making. So this refinery fire in Richmond is just emblematic of the kind of challenge we have in the rest of the country and around the world in taking on fossil fuel industries like Chevron.
Well, Roger Kim, it also indicates how frail the supply chain is, because already prices of gasoline are going up in California, and apparently they are expected to go up over $4 a gallon. We were just enjoying a downturn in the high price of gasoline, and now, because of this one fire, apparently gas in California is going to get more and more expensive. So what does that say about this supply chain and how tenuous it is and how much we depend upon these refineries?
I think this accentuates the point that we need a transition away from these fuels. The supply chain is only going to get even harder. Not only is it important that we transition away to make sure that we're protecting our climate and people's health, but the future of our planet depends on it. We can't depend on fossil fuel anymore. We actually need to accelerate our transition to cleaner and renewable fuels. And with companies like Chevron hanging on, as hard as possible to keep these kinds of refineries going and not investing, to eke out as much more profit as possible, I think is a huge problem.
So Reuters are reporting that in response to this fire at the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California on Monday, Reuters are reporting that the Richmond refinery, as I'm just quoting, has long been a matter of contention for Bay Area environmental groups, and I imagine that includes you. In 2008, local groups sued to halt a planned upgrade to the refinery that would have allowed it to operate more efficiently and to produce new types of crude, arguing the environmental review for the project was incomplete. Now, that article in Reuters somewhat lays the blame at your doorstep.
That's absolutely deceptive. What Chevron proposed to do in that project was actually an expansion of the refinery. They were going to be refining dirtier and heavier grades of crude oil, but they did not disclose that as a part of the environmental review process, and that's why we sued to stop their project, and we won in several rounds in the courts. The crude unit that caught fire on Monday was not even a part of the proposed project that Chevron submitted for back in 2005. So that's absolutely false. We have, again, as I said before, have been advocating for Chevron to replace old pieces of equipment and continue to ask for Chevron to do that, especially in the wake of this fire. And then to try to lay the blame on our feet is absolutely deceptive.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Kim, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network in San Francisco, where he has been active for some time in trying to improve environmental conditions, particularly in the low-income area surrounding the Richmond refinery. Now, the crude that they are processing, you said they're dirtier crude. Is that coming from Alaska? This is most of the oil that comes in there comes from Alaska and the Middle East, I understand.
Yeah, I mean, Chevron buys its crude oil off the global market, so, you know, some of it comes from Alaska, some of it from the Middle East, some of it, you know, potentially is pre-processed tar sands as well, but as the sweeter, quote-unquote, sort of cleaner oils are diminishing, they want to transition to refining the dirtier and heavier oils, which means even higher content of pollution and metals and other chemicals that will end up in our communities and then in the lungs of our members and kids in Richmond.
So this is, in fact, this is what the future will be. You're saying that because the expensive sweet crude that's all but gone in Texas, and it's more expensive, of course, to get it to the West Coast from the Middle East. I believe Nigeria also has sweet crude, but half of that oil is, in fact, stolen, my understanding is. So this is the future then. More dirtier oil, and this refinery that's built in 1902 is going to have to meet that challenge. And I take it what you're saying here, Roger Kim, is that they simply aren't investing in what needs to be done, let alone transitioning to alternatives.
What I'm saying is the future that Chevron is choosing is a dead end. And we actually need to transition away from these fuels, not only for the sake of the lives and health of communities that live around refineries and other fossil fuel plants, but for the sake of the future of our planet. We see the wildfires and drought and heat waves across the country this year and around the world. We really need to do more to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And the only way to do this is to actually transition more quickly to cleaner and more renewable energies. And that is the future that Chevron should be investing in instead of taking us down this path of destruction.
Well, it seems, though, in a kind of ironic and rather crude way, that the more these big companies screw up by having defective equipment and having leaks that cause explosions and cause environmental damage and irritation to the lungs and breathing of people in the neighborhood, that the price of gas automatically goes up. So they're rewarded one way or the other. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is why should we consumers have to pay more for the lax behavior of these big corporations?
I agree. And I think we need to use all the tools in our toolbox and take away the subsidies from oil companies, help accelerate the development of cleaner, renewable energies, get a handle on how gas prices are moving in our country as well, and hold these companies accountable. I don't think they should profit off of a disaster like the one we just had here on Monday. We need our leaders and national leaders to get a handle on this issue.
Well, Roger Kim, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we've just been speaking with Roger Kim, the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, which organizes and builds the leadership of Asian immigrants and refugee communities to achieve environmental and social justice. Before joining APEN, he worked at the Oakland Foundation as the Environmental Program Fellow and at Global Green USA. In addition, Mr. Kim is on the board of the Center for Environmental Health and the Advisory Committee to Congresswoman Barbara Lee. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how teddy bears were parachuted into Belarus, enraging the dictator. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Marples, a distinguished university professor in the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta. He's also the director of the Stashyuk Program for the Study of Contemporary Ukraine at the University of Alberta and president of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies. He's the author of The Lukashenko Phenomenon, Elections, Propaganda, and the Foundations of Political Authority in Belarus, Prospect for Democracy in Belarus, and Belarus, a Denationalized Nation. His latest book is Russia in the 20th Century, The Quest for Stability. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Marples.
Thank you.
And you also have an article at the Eurasia Daily Monitor, Swedish Ambassador's Departure from Belarus. And, of course, that is the latest scandal, if you will, in Belarus. It stems from a public relations stunt by a Swedish public relations firm who parachuted in a bunch of teddy bears, almost as sort of innocuous in a way as what's going on in Moscow with the three young punk rockers having the book thrown at them. But this guy in Belarus, he's truly a throwback, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And, you know, but one of the things he's always boasted about is that Belarus was the nation that bore the brunt of losses in World War II, but eventually, along with the rest of the Soviet forces, got rid of the fascists, freed Europe, and that the borders are basically sacrosanct and nothing is ever going to come through them again. And at the same time, he just signed an agreement with Russia and Kazakhstan for a joint defense force on the borders of each country. So it's very embarrassing for him, having made these boasts, that this plane could just come through the border seemingly undetected and then drop off all these teddy bears, something like 800 altogether. And, you know, so I think he's actually lashing out as a result of that, more than anything else that the Swedish, you know, anything that the Swedish ambassador did, for example. He seems to have been completely unaware of what was going to happen, had nothing to do with it, never made a statement about it, as far as I can tell. And yet, you know, he's the one who's really borne the brunt of the anger of the president.
And this was obviously, I can't imagine that the Swedish public relations firm would have cleared this stunt in advance with the Swedish authorities, who clearly would not have supported it. But it has led to the firing, has it not, of almost all the top people in generals, the chairman of the State Border Committee, the head of air defenses, the head of the armed forces was reprimanded, the defense minister as well, first deputy minister, state secretary of security, chairman of the state security, they're the KGB as they call themselves. Lukashenko lashed out at them too.
Yes, I mean, everyone is a scapegoat for this one. And certainly, you know, theoretically, they were responsible for the lack of vigilance, you might say, over the border. But in reality, probably there wasn't a whole lot people in Minsk could have done about it. I mean, people sitting in the KGB offices, like the head of the KGB, would have been absolutely clueless that this little stunt was about to take place. And I think also, officially, nothing was actually said about it for a couple of weeks. And I think the authorities would have been quite happy to keep it quiet. The problem was that when people were picking up these teddy bears, some people were taking photographs, putting them on the internet, and one of them sent one of the teddy bears, I believe, to a photographer who had his own blog site, and it was publicized there. And someone else actually took a clip of the teddy bears landing in the town of Ivanets, about 30 or 40 miles or so from Minsk. And all this went around the YouTube. So once this happened, it was on a kind of world level. There was no longer any possibility of the government denying that it had happened or ignoring it anymore. And Lukashenko probably found out about it then too. And that seems to have inflamed his anger even more.
Well, of course, he's lashed out at the poor, unfortunate blogger, the 20-year-old photojournalist, right, who published this stuff on the internet, and he's now accused of assisting in an illegal border crossing.
He's accused of assisting a border crossing, and since I wrote my article, I heard the young girl who gave him a photograph has actually been arrested too. I think she's even younger than he is. Yeah, and it's very, you know, it is analogous, I think, to what's happening with Pussy Riot in Moscow. It seems in a way that, you know, you get these old-style hardline leaders who simply can't deal with new forms of public information and social media, and they don't really know how to go about censoring it in any kind of meaningful way. So no matter how repressive these regimes, there's always something seems to happen to embarrass them. And as you say, is now lashed out at Sweden. And since yesterday, all the Swedish embassy officials have been asked to leave Minsk now. The entire embassy has been closed down. So it's not just the ambassador now and a couple of officials. The whole thing is shut down. So it's created a major international impasse. I mean, the two countries haven't actually broken off diplomatic relations yet, but, you know, that would be the logical next step.
Again, I'm speaking with David Marples, a distinguished university professor in the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta, where he directs the Stashuk program in the study of contemporary Ukraine, and also he's the head of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies. We're talking about how a Swedish public relations firm staged a stunt by flying a small aircraft in from Lithuania over the airspace of Belarus, dropping about 800 teddy bears onto the town of Ivanets. And as David said, nothing was heard of it until it got onto YouTube. And now the poor person who put it on YouTube is being scapegoated. And you mentioned a minute ago the inability of these dictatorial totalitarian regimes and their leadership adjusting to the new internet age. Is that to say that at some point or other there's going to be a Belarusian spring?
Yeah, that may be going a little too far right now, but I certainly think there are signs of it happening, especially among younger people. I think a lot of the problems with Belarus really depend on the economic situation. You know, if people are seriously in economic difficulties, can't find food products in stores, wages don't keep pace with inflation, etc., as was the case last year, then you may really see some signs of change. But at the moment, through extensive borrowing from China, from Russia in particular, also the CIS's own fund, Lukashenko's government has sort of managed to circumvent an immediate crisis. So in addition, they've given enormous powers to the KGB to crack down on the slightest sign of any public demonstrations. The most ridiculous example of this occurred last summer when some people were arrested for clapping in public. That was seen as a sign of subversion. And at that same time, there happened to be some war veterans on a military parade, and Lukashenko made an exception and said that people would be allowed to clap the war veterans, but in fact, no one else. So even clapping became a public offense. And in one example, a one-armed man was arrested for clapping. So, you know, it's a joke in a way. And in fact, the founder of the firm that sent the teddy bears, a man called Per Cromwell, wrote a letter to Lukashenko in which he told him that he was regarded on the internet as a clown. And I think that nothing hurts dictators more than being made to look stupid and ridiculous in the public eye.
Well, but you know, what you're telling us, David Marbles, it sounds like that Charlie Chaplin film, The Dictator. I mean, the guy is a clown, isn't he? And he's also an anachronism.
He is, you know, but for some time, he managed to sort of strike a chord with a sector of the public, mainly the elderly, mainly people who could remember the war, mainly people who were nostalgic for Soviet times. And it's often forgotten that the Republic of Belarus, and it's only today about 9.5 million, was actually one of the better-off republics in the latter part of the Soviet Union's existence. I mean, economically, they were doing quite well, mainly, you know, producing machine tools, tractors, things of that nature. But after the end of the Soviet Union, the population suffered a dramatic loss in the standard of living. Many people simply couldn't afford to even go out shopping. And in 1994, when Lukashenko came to power, he put a stop to all privatization, to the introduction of market forces, any kind of reforms, and introduced this kind of national state system over the economy, Soviet style, of course, but heavily subsidized, so that everybody got a wage and everybody at the end of their career would get a pension. And, you know, that proved, not surprisingly, quite popular among the population as long as it could last. But it could only last as long as Russia provided cheap oil and gas and other products that Belarus could then resell on the world market. And that stopped around 2002 to 2004, in that kind of period, when Russia started to charge world prices for their gas and oil. So it's a fairly recent phenomenon, I think, that Lukashenko's been in any kind of trouble. And he's been in power for 18 years, you know, so not Gaddafi, but nevertheless, it's a long time.
Well, my understanding, though, is that what supplements this sclerotic Soviet-style economy is smuggling. They're on the border between Belarus and Poland. That was, in effect, the border between the communist-style economies in the West. And isn't that true, that there's enormous amounts of smuggling go on? And weren't they also smuggling oil?
Yes. Smuggling went on. And one other product that was smuggled quite on a regular basis was weapons. Belarus has supplied arms to some of the, let's say, less pleasant states of the world. And this was a profitable operation. I think it's become more difficult now to penetrate the Polish border quite so easily. It still happens. But since Poland joined the European Union, it's become more difficult. And, you know, every truck or even train that goes over the border is there for an hour or two. I mean, everything is really checked more thoroughly anyway than in the past. But these were the means, I think, by which Belarus has managed to survive as, you know, let's say a state that's not communist, but it's by no means a capitalist one either. I mean, it's some sort of state authoritarian, carefully controlled by the government. Every facet of the economy is controlled.
Well, David Marples, Lukashenko himself, of course, is a former border guard. So as you point out in your article at Eurasia Daily Monitor, he took this quite personally, being a former border guard himself, as well as his two elder sons have also served in that position. But, of course, you have to contrast this paranoid reaction to this Swedish public relations stunt of dropping teddy bears from a light aircraft to what happened in 1987 in the USSR when a 19-year-old German pilot landed a Cessna in Red Square. The Russians certainly didn't behave as brutally and as arbitrarily as Lukashenko is in this case. So again, it gets down to the idea that this is a dictatorship in Europe, the last dictator. I'm not that Putin is anything less, but at least Putin goes through the cosmetic ritual of pretending to be democratic.
Well, I mean, actually, I think you've hit the right spot there. I think Putin's credibility now is also coming into question. And that really would make life a lot more difficult for Lukashenko, because even though the two of them don't really get along, it is still Russia that's propping up this sort of decrepit state in Belarus. And if Russia should, at some point get rid of Putin, have some kind of democratic election or massive public protest, I think that would spill over into Belarus and even Ukraine, of course, where Ukraine's situation is deteriorating as well in terms of democracy. So the more isolated I think Lukashenko is, the more likely we are to see some changes. And, he's focused on Sweden. And I think, one reason why is that the Swedish ambassador was also seen by the regime as a kind of focus of subversion, opposition groups. He would always hang around with people, and he spoke fluent Belarusian, which is very, very rare among embassy staff. Many of them will speak Russian, but very few will speak the local language. And it gave him a distinct advantage, I think, in Belarusian society, where he could simply wander around and talk to anyone, and became very popular as a result, and was seen as a kind of representative of a Europe that wanted change in Belarus. I think Sweden has actually not been the most forceful country in terms of reprimanding Lukashenko every time he commits a human rights abuse. But nevertheless, anyone who can speak fluent Belarusian in the embassy staff is regarded as a big problem. So I think, this was a good excuse for Belarus to get rid of a troublesome ambassador.
Yes, the Swedes are not famous for being aggressive or assertive. So David Marples, again, distinguished university professor at the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta, where he directs the Stasiuk program in the study of contemporary Ukraine. He's also the president of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies. I guess, in a way, the Belarusians are the beneficiaries of the fact that the Russians, at the behest of the West, decided not to sell the advanced S-300 ground-to-air anti-aircraft missile system, which is that's apparently a part of the system that you mentioned earlier, with Russia bolstering the air defenses of Kazakhstan and Belarus. I guess this is a gift, right? The S-300 system?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I mean, I couldn't say from Alberta, Canada, but I'm assuming it's not in place yet.
Right.
It's supposed to be in place by 2013. But the reverse side of this, of course, is that if the plane had been immediately shot down, you and I would be having a conversation about something quite different. But, ultimately we would be condemning Lukashenko even more than we are now.
Right.
So, what really would have been the best solution? I mean, as far as this public relations scheme was concerned, I mean, this is a pretty dangerous thing to do. And, I would imagine, no matter what the country, there would have been some kind of protest. But it's really the overreaction, I think, that causes the raised eyebrows, arresting some young kid for putting a photograph on the internet. It's just stupid, I think. And I see it as a sign of insecurity and weakness. This is what I wrote in the article. Obviously, very frightened, watching what's happening in the Middle East and all these regimes coming tumbling down, and thinking, I could be the next one.
Right.
I believe, all dictators must have very private thoughts, you know, because who do they talk to? In Lukashenko's case, he doesn't live with his wife anyway. He lives with his seven-year-old son. And it created a kind of paranoia almost of being surrounded by enemies. And sooner or later, you know, people are going to try and overthrow him. I don't think it's really coming. You know, I don't really see where it's coming from, but that seems to be how he thinks.
Well, just in closing, David Marples, I recall that an American hot air balloonist drifted into Belarusian airspace, and they shot him down, and he died. I mean, the air defense.
Two of them, actually.
Two of them, really? I mean,
yeah.
What kind of paranoia is that? You can see a slow-moving balloon. You know it's not, you know, a B-52 bomber. What the, you know, that was a pretty amazing when that happened.
Yeah, and that was 17 years ago, you know, so not a lot has changed.
Hmm. Well, I take it then that we can only hope that your point is that really the important change would have to happen in Russia, as long as, because that's the sponsor of this guy. So if Putin is rolling back the clock on democracy as much as he can, if there's a countervailing Russian revolution from the people against this new authoritarianism, then eventually that'll be the beginning of the end of Lukashenko.
Yeah, and sometimes these things happen quite suddenly, quite unexpectedly. I mean, I think people of Belarus are very, you know, peace-loving, quiet, unobtrusive. There's a, you know, distinct lack of what you might call jingoistic type of nationalism there. I mean, you hardly would know that you cross the border from Russia to Belarus, for example, in terms of scenery, how people speak, how they behave or whatever. So, you know, they're a quiet people by nature. But, you know, eventually people get tired of the same thing over and over again if it's not bringing any results. And I think with the economic downturn, an obvious lack of ideas, and now, you know, brutality magnified in so many different ways over the past couple of years, people are getting tired of it. And sooner or later they will want a change. I mean, I don't think it's going to come through a ballot box because all the elections are carefully controlled. It's got to come from sort of ground roots, public protests, with some help from outside. And I think that help would probably mean it has to come from Russia.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Marples.
Yep, you're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with David Marples, who's a distinguished university professor in the Department of History and Classics at the University of Alberta, where he directs the Stashyuk program for the study of contemporary Ukraine. He's also president of the North American Association for Belarusian Studies and the author of The Lukashenko Phenomenon, Elections, Propaganda, and the Foundations of Political Authority in Belarus, Prospects for Democracy in Belarus, and Belarus, a Denationalized Nation. His latest book is Russia in the 20th Century, The Quest for Stability. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.